Come to Morricone Island. It's Devin 11 show for your film and TV soundtracks. It's the number one place to go. From old world to new. Like a cool breeze coming through. Yes, it's Morricone Island.
You are tuned to Morricone Island on WFMU. I'm your host, Devin Levins, here every Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. playing the soundtrack hits. This week is no exception. Joining us, the Octopus Project. They're returning. Austin, Texas's own. We'll be speaking with the three founding members, Josh Lambert, Yvonne Lambert, and Toto Miranda, promoting two vinyl soundtrack releases coming out just recently and one upcoming. First is for Sasquatch Sunset, which is the band's fourth collaboration with the director team, David and Nathan Zellner, aka the Zellner Brothers. And that film stars Jesse Eisenberg and Riley Keough as two of the four chronicled Sasquatches, I don't know. And the vinyl's coming out in July 2024 on Mutant. And also, secondarily, there's a documentary soundtrack that came out just recently for Record Store Day. And that's Earth Libraries. And that's for the PBS children's television show, Reading Rainbow. You've probably seen it. It's hosted, presented, acted by LeVar Burton of Roots and Star Trek fame. And I implore you all, if you're not familiar with the band, go back to the archive, July 31st, 2018, when the band was in studio in town for a show at Elsewhere. And Damsel had just come out, the third collaboration with the Zellners. But I guess that's a long-winded way of saying welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really, really excited to be back.
This is the fourth collaboration with the Zellners. And maybe just describe, if you can, quickly, like who are the Zellner Brothers and your experience with your fourth collaboration with them.
The Zellner Brothers are two brothers. We met them in Austin about 20-plus years ago. We've just been like really good friends since then. They made a bunch of shorts for a while that we would score, and then in turn they would make music videos for us, and then that kind of turned into doing scoring features for them as they sort of like leveled up, and we've just been along for the ride with them since.
Each one seems a bit different, right? Each score that you've put out is, each film's very different, and I think the music obviously comes out different. The last one was more of a Western, I guess you would say, and we were talking about Americana.
Yeah. They always try on pretty different ideas for each project, and each one has felt distinctive kind of from the very beginning. And that, and the fact that they're so hands-on and kind of take a DIY approach even as their productions level up, help us and them feel like kindred spirits when we get to work together.
Mm. What influences were you drawing upon, or were they kind of throwing out there or temping or anything like that? Like what was the discussion like?
Originally, before they, like we got in like super early, like script stage with them, and which we kind of generally do, and then just start talking about like ideas, influences, and references and stuff. And initially, when we started, they really wanted it to sound like 70s, like nature documentary music. Before they even started shooting, we just wrote a bunch of like, you know, acoustic guitar and flute stuff. And then after, when they started shooting and then started editing, they kind of got into it and realized like, oh, this needs to be more epic. This needs to be, you know, XYZ. Popova was a big one that they referenced, and Miles Davis. They really wanted like some like Bitches Brew era.
It's like kind of freak out.
Yeah.
Miles Davis.
As they started going through what they actually had on film, they started requesting it to be bigger and weirder. I think they initially pictured a more, a calmer, pastoral is the word I keep coming to. I want to do something different, but that's maybe the best word, a pastoral vibe. And then as they started to get the footage back and having spent all that time out in the forest, which feels kind of grand and epic and a little bit, you know, bigger than life, they started requesting the music to take that turn as well.
Yeah. One thing that I really liked in the process too was there was a point where David was like, I challenge you to go weirder. Like, I want you to go as weird as you like possibly can and just make this as crazy as you can. And we're like, oh, sure, challenge accepted. Yeah, that sounds like a dream.
It was really fun to work on.
Yeah. I'm glad you said Popovac because I just had, even like in my notes, I wrote Aguirre. I was sort of thinking like, yeah, these Werner Herzog films, like Cobra Verde and Aguirre, where it's like, it's probably a combination also of like the landscape of the visuals.
You know, yeah. Like, yeah. I think Herzog is definitely a touchstone for them. And when they open the movie with, you know, misty mountains, it's hard to not throw a little bit of the choral sound in there.
Yeah.
Heart of Glass.
It's sort of like Mellotron and synth stuff and just vocal sounding. There's also prominently featured a song, Creatures of Nature, which is sung by one of the four only characters in the film, or at least Sasquatch characters. And that's sung by Riley Keough. And that almost has, to me, like a Wicker Man vibe or something, you know, like, again, it's probably the flutes and the acoustic guitars and all that. But how did that come about?
The original reference that we were given before writing that song was a song called Come Wander With Me, sung by Bonnie Beecher in an old Twilight Zone episode. It's a beautiful song, very folky. David Zellner wrote the lyrics and kind of sang a basic melody into his iPhone. And we went from there, writing the song and putting the lyrics to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we wanted to have the kind of like Come Wander With Me and Wicker Man and like even Simon and Garfunkel or like Rosemary's Baby, like those kind of late 60s, mid 60s kind of like folky, haunty vibe.
Did you record that remotely or was that together in the same room or anything?
We did the music here, and then Riley did her vocals separately.
And that's a theme with the Zellners, having the actor sing? Is that right? I remember.
Well, David is, despite not being a musician in the traditional sense, a pretty great songwriter. He has like a really good facility with like concepts and how to use genre. And I think that's someplace he likes to go to kind of flesh out the world of the films.
And originally, like, we didn't know who was going to sing it. I mean, we knew Riley was going to be in the movie and knew that she was like an amazing singer, but hadn't really landed on, like, we wrote it and we're like, oh, we need to get somebody to sing this. And he asked her and she was like so excited to do it. And we were just like exploding with joy.
Yeah. The campsite scene when the Love to Hate Erasure, the Love to Hate You song comes in. Again, that was like another kind of out of left field choice. I assume one of the Zellners went for that and it has some significance.
It was always in the script and they've said repeatedly they never considered anything else. It always had to be Erasure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And kind of also subsequently, they asked us to make all of the music sound nothing like as far away from that as possible because they wanted that to be such a like, what the fuck moment. You know?
Increase the left fieldness. We had to move the whole field to the right so that left.
Any idea, like on their Erasure camp, were they easy to get the rights or was it a difficult process, anything like that that you guys heard about?
I think it was pretty easy.
I remember them saying it came down to like they were using like 32 seconds and they had agreed to 30. So there were some technical back and forth, but I think they were into the idea.
Yeah.
As far as I heard.
I don't think it was that easy. I do remember them talking about the great effort they had to take to license it in the first place and then to get extra seconds.
Yeah, I think it maybe went from like 30 to 90 seconds. It was like maybe a huge jump. Okay. I forget exactly, but yeah.
Yeah, there's rules with that. And like if you repeat the song, I don't know if you guys are Joe Parra fans, but like the TV show like reuses Bobo O'Reilly something like 18 times because he's just obsessed with the song and he keeps playing it. They had to pay. They had like spent their entire budget on licensing Bobo O'Reilly.
It's a good song.
Yeah. Amazing episode if you haven't seen of Joe Parra.
No, I haven't.
What about, so when you get the initial call and they say there's no dialogue, no like human dialogue, I guess. I saw that like Jesse Eisenberg was like down immediately. He's like, geez, you know, I just get to act. I don't have to speak or whatever, or speak as a human. And he was excited about it.
I think when you read the script, it just feels pretty, the whole thing feels pretty integrated. There's no like declaration in the script about there not being dialogue, there just isn't. And so it all feels like very of a piece.
And as the composers, you probably gives you the opportunity to do a lot more, right? You get to fill a lot more space.
Yeah, for sure. Although this has come up as well, that I think it's our tendency in general, and I think their tendency as filmmakers, to not underscore too much dialogue anyway. We generally leave those, I mean, not exclusively, but generally leave those scenes open anyhow. So it was, the images are kind of the most fun to work with in general. So yeah, there was more opportunity to do that.
Do any of you believe in Bigfoot?
I don't disbelieve.
Yeah. I'm open to it for sure.
Yeah.
I've met some true believers, very serious believers over the course of working on this project. And so, yeah, very passionate people.
But I'm taking it you've never seen a real Sasquatch. Like in the filming of this, they didn't actually reveal one or anything.
we actually went up to Humboldt County, like where they shot, like during pre-production, to like do like field recordings and stuff. And saw a bunch of wooden Sasquatches.
Yeah. Ari Aster was a executive producer. Was he involved?
He was. I don't know on the back end to what extent he was involved. His production team and the people that all did all of the practical, the, like the costumes and everything, are like his group of folks. Like it was kind of like a lot of people that work on his films basically worked on this one as well. So
big fan of his films.
Yeah, we are as well.
And you guys are now in his orbit.
It's kind of weird.
How did it all come about with Butterfly in the Sky? Very different project, I think.
Yeah, kind of a polar opposite.
Actually happened well before Sasquatch.
Yeah, right. That we started working on that in 2021, I think. Maybe summer of 2021.
Yeah.
We met the directors at South by, I think, 2018, 2017, 2018, something like that. And just, you know, became friends.
They were there at the time with A Life in Waves, the Suzanne Ciani documentary, which we saw and got to know them at that South by while they were promoting that.
They were involved with that?
Yeah, they directed it.
They're the directors? Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Yeah. If anybody hasn't seen it, go check it out.
Because I saw that they had directed something before, but I thought it was something completely different together. Yeah. As a duo. It's Bradford Thomason and Brad Whitcomb. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, they did. They've done a bunch of stuff. They did a Glow documentary. Yeah. They did one about, I'm trying to remember.
Jasper Mall.
Yeah, Jasper Mall.
Jasper Mall. Yeah, that's the one I recognized.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize they were Suzanne Ciani as well, right?
Yeah.
So it makes sense. So I assume that.
They then, when they got started on this, reached out to us, which they very flatteringly thought of us for the score and had the idea of kind of extrapolating the whole thing from the kind of beginning of the theme song, the kind of bubbling synth arpeggio that everybody knows, which I think is one of the main things everybody takes away from the show is weirdly like those, like just a couple of, the whole song is amazing, of course, but just those couple of seconds like that, those few notes and LeVar are like the stars of the show kind of. and they, very flatteringly thought of us to kind of take it from there and score the film.
And so did they know your music, or it was just that meeting at South by Southwest?
They did know our music as well.
They knew it as well.
Yeah. I mean, totally different from like Damsel and stuff like that, but they were fans of that and Kimiko and just other things that we'd done in the past and our regular band stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's a scene in there in the film where the original composer, was it Stephen Horlick? Was that his name?
Yes. Yeah.
Explains how he came up with the theme song, right?
Yes.
Which is pretty interesting, I think, to the soundtrack fan, not just the average person. Was he involved in any way? Do you have any connection to him?
Not with the music that we wrote for the film, but we met him at the premiere, and he's such a cool guy, like such a delightful weirdo as well. He's great.
We've talked about doing something together.
Yes.
Which hasn't come to pass yet, but I think we're all pretty interested.
Yeah. Is he in New York still, or what's he up to these days?
I feel like he's doing a lot of stuff. I don't know how much composing, but he is in New York still. It seems like he has his hand in a lot of pies. So. Yeah. Is that a phrase? I don't know.
Hand in a
lot
of
pies. He's stuck his... It is now.
It sounds like a saying to me. I don't know.
Sure. Josh's idioms.
Yeah, I was unfamiliar because this is about Reading Rainbow, a TV show that was, I don't know when it started, like 83, 84, and went on through the early 2000s on PBS for children, getting them, inspiring them to read more. And LeVar Burton was on, like, on board from the beginning and excited to, you know, give back and to the world by getting children to read and stop playing video games or whatever. I kind of miss this show. Like, I didn't know it. I grew up on, you know, Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street and Electric Company. My wife, who's a couple years older, maybe, maybe not, she was all over it. She knew it, not the right age group, you know, the target audience of getting kids to read when it came out. But she was all in on it as a LeVar Burton fan post-Roots. Did you all grow up watching it? Did you know it?
Yeah,
absolutely. Sure. Yeah, I think it was Reading Rainbow and 3-2-1 Contact were two big ones for me. Mm-hmm. PBS.
I remember that too. Was there? Did you get to meet LeVar Burton? I guess first and foremost.
We did.
Also at the premiere, it was.
They premiered it at Tribeca in 2022, and we went to the after party and hung out, and just it was like small, and just, you know, LeVar and the people that worked on Reading Rainbow and some people that worked on the film. And we first got there and we saw LeVar and we're like, oh my God, we have to go say hi. And so we walked up and like I introduced myself and us and like we're the composers of the film and basically just was like, I love Reading Rainbow, I love Star Trek, blah, 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 and just kind of like blacked out. And I don't really remember much of the rest because I was so nervous to meet, you know, this amazing human. And he was so kind and gracious and just like, you know, basically like, it's okay. Like, you know, like, thank you. And, you know, let's take a picture. So.
His sustained eye contact was pretty memorable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's really listening and really looking at you when you, mm-hmm. If one gets to meet him.
He's exactly the person that you would imagine. Just so kind.
Did he comment on the music? Did he?
I feel like he said he liked it. I again, kind of don't remember a lot of the conversation.
The epitome of graciousness, so I'm sure he at least said so.
Yeah.
Well, you all must have, I mean, it sounds like you must have, from the beginning, you must have started by drawing inspiration from just those crazy 80s and maybe even before PBS sounds.
Yes.
I mean, PBS was really the pioneers of a lot of sense stuff. I would say.
Yeah. I think kind of like I was saying, those few notes at the beginning are an example of, like you were saying, a lot of the PBS stuff of that era, I think was really formative to a lot of people of our age group who are musicians now, and you can hear it all over the place in all kinds of different ways. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely a treat to get to focus on that. I don't know how much we have like specifically tried to build something on that before. So it was really, really cool to get to play with those colors.
Did you go back and kind of study what instruments they were using and how they were doing things, or probably don't have the luxury of the time, right?
I guess on our end, I don't think we did. Maybe personally kind of wanted it to not be such a direct taking from that, as of maybe more of a feeling that I had of the music of that time. And more vibey, I think,
outside of the theme song, the music that Steve wrote for the show isn't overly synthy. It's a lot like it covers a lot of different ground, and he's trying to do different stylistic things based on where the episode is going.
Right.
But like Josh was saying, more of a feeling, more of a vibe, and kind of like extrapolating an imaginary world out of the theme song.
Mm-hmm. What did you use primarily? I mean, were there any analog synths or anything that you leaned heavily on?
Yeah. We had acquired not too long before that a Moog Matriarch. So that got a lot of use.
A bunch of random, like an old Yamaha and like a...
The Korg.
I'm just like looking back at myself. this Korg and then this Roland.
And then also a lot of plugins. The Arturia stuff is really good for, especially when you're trying to do a thing inspired by an era, to just like pull up a CS80 or, you know, or the Buchla plugin. Like, you know, Steve has the actual Buchla that he put on the theme song, but to get to mess with those sounds without spending $25,000 on the synthesizer.
And we actually used Steve Horlick's instructions that appear in the documentary and how to exactly dial in that beginning arpeggio. We used his instructions from the film to plug it in to make our own.
And there's a like a cover of the theme by Flaming Lips. Are you involved with that, or is that just completely them?
We did the music and we asked Wayne if he would sing on it. And Wayne and Steven both made some awesome recordings that we then incorporated into the final version of the song.
The music's us, the singing's mostly them.
Yeah.
One other thing. I'm always like a sucker for Odd Time stuff. And then I noticed like the LeVar track was an Odd Time. The track that it's entitled LeVar. I counted 16, 8, but it was like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Anything in particular spires that Odd Time signature? Or just comes out that way?
I think it just comes out that way. Like, that just comes from messing around and, like, playing
it's
stuff.
What felt right,
yeah.
I guess, really, at the time.
Especially when you're working with loops, at least having one element be in an Odd Time can feel a lot more satisfying than just a neat.
Yeah.
You can kind of feel the seams a little bit more if it's in a even time.
I do really love, like, having something in, like, 4-4, but adding, like a 5-4 melody on top, or, like, a thing that's kind of, like... So it's all kind of shifting separate from each other. I don't know. It makes it feel like it's not just like a loop or something.
Right. Know? It's hard to find the one or whatever.
Yeah.
With theme beginning also was like 7-8, I think. That's like kind of keyed me into it all. And then, so also this came out for Record Store Day, a double LP with the Coke bottle, clear vinyl, and all kinds of splatter and stuff like that. And so these are all different labels putting out your work at this point.
Yeah.
Are you finding them? They're finding you?
Both. Let's see. Earth Libraries put out Butterfly, and they're old friends with the directors, and so they were involved from the beginning.
They also put out the Life in Waves mm-hmm. soundtrack and a couple other of the film.
The Jasper Mall soundtrack.
Yeah,
And
then for Sasquatch, we'd worked with Milan on Damsel before. And so we reached out to them to see if they would be interested in doing the digital version. And they totally were, which was awesome. And then Mutant, it's some of the folks that used to run Mondo back in the day. And they just started Mutant back up, I guess, earlier this year. And they're like, you know, a dream label to work with. And so we reached out and they were also very excited about it. So I feel very lucky to three different labels are excited to put out our stuff right now.
Three different cool labels.
So amazing.
Is Mutant / Mondo, are they Austin?
They are. Yeah.
They're still,
partially.
They're still there. Yeah. What's happening what's next? What's in the future? Any chance you're going out and doing any live scoring of Sasquatch Sunset? Any plans for anything
funny
like that?
Funny that you asked that. actually, we are literally working on right now. Trying to do a live show of soundtrack stuff and ambient, kind of like a different thing than our normal band live show, but incorporating a lot of the soundtrack work
not quite a live scoring thing, but trying to present that material
in a live setting.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
and that would include some of the other soundtrack stuff you're working on. It sounds like. I mean, you had worked on in the past.
Trying to pull stuff from all the score catalog and weave it together into a kind of immersive thing.
With visuals and the
like. It's still a little bit little bit embryonic at this point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Coming soon.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What about just your normal studio album, the band?
That too. That also.
Yeah. that too. Coming soon.
We're going to do so much stuff real soon.
We have a few, I guess a couple like finished songs for a new record and about a million snippets and demo ideas and stuff. And it's a good problem to have, but I feel like since the pandemic started, we keep getting asked to work on films, which keeps taking up most of our time. So we haven't had a ton of time to focus on regular band songs. So yeah, we're going to be definitely doing that more and more of that this year.
Excited to get to that.
And then hopefully more scoring as well. So
yeah. So the last record was around the time I saw you in like 2017, 2018. Yeah. Memory. Remember.
Yeah. Yes.
It's very weird to think about. But.
Right. But it sounds like you guys have been busy like during the pandemic. If you were going to writing music and going to premiere slightly right after, and you must have kept busy during that time. And then any live shows planned? I saw that you did something at South by Southwest, it looks like, elsewhere.
Yeah.
New York, California?
Not at the moment. I mean, the sound, like kind of the soundtrack ambient show, like we'll be probably doing in LA first. hopefully later this year is what we're talking about, but regular band stuff. I mean, nothing on the books right now, just because we've been focusing on all this. But
and yeah. I guess lastly, any soundtracks that you can talk about, anything film scoring, video game scoring, TV, whatever, anything like that on the horizon?
Well, we've been actually writing a lot of music for the Alamo Drafthouse pre-show. So if you go and watch a film at the Alamo Drafthouse right now, you might not realize it, but you're listening to a lot of our music.
Yeah. They're like
feature presentation and some of the Don't Talk stuff. I'm not sure exactly what has rolled out where, but we've been working on a lot of their pre-show bumpers.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah. Like famously in New York, I don't think people realize this, the Film Forum, which is like one of the great indie, you know, film houses there, been there for years and amazing programming in New York City. But like the Film Forum bumper logo, you know, whatever you call it, sound logo, that people have been listening to for whatever it is, 30 years is Carter Burwell.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of...
Are you serious?
Yeah, you could like Google it on or YouTube it and you can nice. See this thing. It's just...
That's crazy.
It's very much like a... You know, a sound logo.
That's, yeah, that's really so cool.
But yeah, that's cool that when you find out that
get off there.
This thing you've been seeing a million times is like one of your favorite bands or one of your favorite composers. So
yeah. It's pretty fun to work in the micro format after we, you know, have been working on these like 90-minute films to have to come up with a score for 7 seconds worth of pictures. Yeah. is a cool contrast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have also been doing like a lot of like the little bumpers before like Alamo, like the Draft House Films, like their film, you know, distribution like thing and
production slate cards. I forget what the term is.
Yeah.
Right.
The little logo at the beginning of the films that they are putting out.
That they're discovering or cleaning up, putting out into the world.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
I'll pay more attention.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, thanks for coming back on and excited to see that you guys are still keeping so busy, especially in the film world, and excited to see what's next.
Yeah. Lots more coming up. So we're very excited to keep going.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's really a joy to be here. Thanks again.
And listeners, I implore you to go to theoctopusproject.com to keep up on the latest news and the latest releases for the band, and also go to Milan Records, figure out how you're going to get the digital or the vinyl version of Sasquatch Sunset. Yep. And lastly, go to earthlibraries.com for The Butterfly in the Sky, the Story of Reading Rainbow documentary 2LP soundtrack as well. And please come back shortly.
We'll try to be back in less than 5 years to have something else to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The door's always
six,
open.
Six even.
Yeah. Six.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Less than six.
Yeah. Pretty close to 6 years.
Set an intention.
It's nuts. Renee, my wife, she who helps with the show, she bought some of your socks at the last show.
Oh, are you serious?
At Elsewhere.
Oh.
And they're
nice.
And I don't get it because I can't, like my pair of socks, I mean, you get a year of use out of them at best for holes and stuff. And like, they're still kicking.
Oh, cool.
So for her. She just treads lightly in them, but like she wears them all the time, and I look at them and I'm like mystified at how long they've kept up. So whoever makes them for you does a good job, I think.
Oh, I
cool,
love
that's
that.
Good to hear.
It's the branding that keeps them.
Yeah,
yeah.
She probably pays them. Like she treats them more carefully. Maybe she doesn't dry them, like she hangs them. Up. I don't know, but anyways, yeah, they're still kicking somehow.
That's good to hear.
All right. Well, talk to you guys soon.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank thanks you. So much.